Nobody covers dog sledding like Mushing from First Paw Media. Our team of athletes, volunteers, race organizers, and mushers like Robert and Michelle Forto brings you closer to this sport. If it's happening, we are there. Live from the qualifying races in January and February, the Iditarod in March, and in the summer, Mushing takes you on the road with our team and trail tour. We connect you with a history of this sport, in-depth interviews with the top mushers, and great storytelling and breaking news all year long. Follow on mushing.com.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto from Mushing Magazine, and I am back sitting here with my good buddy Karosh Parto, and we are back with our dog driver show here on the Mushing Podcast. Karosh, it's been a few years.
Gosh, man, it was almost 5 years ago when we started this first series, and how many did we do?
I think we did over 200. I was looking at my YouTube channel, of all things, a few months ago, and these episodes still pop up. And it's interesting to see some of these people who we talked to back in the day who are still in the sport, who are out of the sport. And for folks that are brand new to us, the Dog Driver Show is primarily focused on sprint and dry land, unlike our other show that covers everything from Iditarod to sprint to everything. We're a little bit different. We're a little bit niched down, aren't we?
Definitely, definitely different. We talk to a lot of interesting folks throughout the episode, all tens and or dozens and dozens of different countries, right? We talk to people all over the world, U.S., Canada, name it, honestly. And so many people listen to these podcasts, too. I was so surprised. You had a map actually showing me, right?
Yes, I remember back then, and I've been podcasting a long time. I started our mushing podcast called Mush You Huskies way back in 2010. Here we are heading into 2026 now, so almost 16 years. And I remember when we met up, I had spoken to a lot of these sprint mushers, and I didn't know a lot of them personally. And here now, since we own Mushing Magazine, and I've gone to a lot of different races and visited a lot of kennels, I've met a lot of these guys who we've spoken to in the past. But yeah, you're right. Back then, over 200 people spoke to us, a lot of Europeans. I think we had several episodes that were in different languages. We've had people that had interpreted for us where they would speak and the other person would interpret for them. It was an interesting podcast for sure, but man, people really liked it.
Yeah, I believe at one point you were telling me we had over 3 million downloads over the years, and we had our own internal bloopers. We would laugh because we would screw up or do something, or somebody would answer with some kind of interesting answer or so, or somebody would, the dog would bark in the background. It was pretty neat. A lot has changed, meanwhile, right, over the last 5 years or so. You, of course, purchased Mushing Magazine, and you started a new business, new endeavor. You've been to many, many podcast shows and to learn new techniques, new technology, and what works and what it doesn't. Tell me about those, actually, and Mushing Magazine in particular.
Well, I bought Mushing Magazine with my wife, Michelle, just about 2 years ago at the time of this recording in 2023. And I thought I knew what I was getting myself into. And I've done a lot of things in my day. And I know you and I have owned businesses and been self-employed and done the whole thing. But owning a magazine is probably the toughest, most challenging, most frustrating businesses I've ever been involved in. It's a tough, tough business. And I tell people all the time that it is, especially in the mushing community, it's tough to please everybody. Everybody has their own idea of what stories they want to hear and what content they want to see. And man, it is tough. And I don't know how many times, Karosh, I have been ready to just throw in the towel and just, I don't know if I want to sell the business, but man, it is a tough hoe to haul.
Oh, definitely. Us mushers, we know it all, right?
Yeah.
We know everything, and we all have our own opinions and everything. And I can imagine Mushing Magazine. I mean, it's a big weight. I remember back in the days when we first came to Alaska, actually, they were selling the magazine at the airport. You could, you know, when you're going by in Anchorage, it's called Houston something or whatever, bookstore or magazine store, you would buy that. And, of course, it's a huge moneymaker for you, right?
huge moneymaker for sure. And we're going to put that in quotes. But, yeah, you're right. Magazines have definitely changed over the years. Of course, we're no longer in those types of places anymore. But we have almost a 50-50 split right now between international subscribers and U.S. subscribers. And I'm putting Canada and Mexico in the U.S. subscriber base. But people are still reading it. People still want the paper magazine. It's very expensive to print. But it's a legacy publication. You know, it's the only magazine that's still published about mushing anywhere in the world, as far as I'm aware, at least in print.
Yeah, definitely. I remember years ago when we had, you know, there was Team and Trail, there was the Isra magazine, there was Mushing Magazine, there were Schlittenhund, the German version of it, Finnish version of it. But now you see less and less. And what was the story? What was the idea behind it? I mean, to get yourself in this headache, quite honestly.
Well, first off, we do own Team and Trail as well. And I know we have some upcoming episodes here from folks right there near Laconia, New Hampshire, where that first started with the Molbergs way back, Molbergs and Fishbacks way back in the late 50s, early 60s. But how did it get started? Nils Hahn and Diana Hacker up in Nome called me up in, I guess it would be mid-2023, and said, we've listened to all your podcasts. Would you be interested in buying Mushing Magazine? So it's interesting how things have come full circle from Mushing Podcast to Mushing Magazine to here we are, Mushing Podcast again. And I remember flying up to Nome with my wife. We were sitting on the floor of the old Nome Nugget, Alaska's oldest newspaper. And we signed a deal right there in the old newspaper office, right there on Front Street, I guess it is. And loaded up all of the back issues in priority mailboxes and took them over to the airport. And as they say, the rest is history.
Yeah, that's how many years has it been around?
It's been around since 1987, so we're getting ready to publish our 203rd issue. That's going to come out either late December, early January.
Man, a lot have changed meanwhile, right?
Oh, yeah. Advertising has dried up compared to back in the day. The stories are still the same. People still have a lot of stories, but it's really tough to cover a sport that is international. You know, as we said, we have a lot of international readers, but how do you cover a sport when, you know, it's thousands and thousands of dollars to travel over there? We're going to talk to a guy later that traveled to Spain. But, man, it's expensive to publish a magazine or a podcast to do it quality.
Do you offhand, do you know how many countries are buying the magazine or listening to the podcasts?
Listening to the podcast is a little bit easier to measure. I think at our last listen, we had about 110 countries, which is pretty dang good. That's about
2/3. 110 countries.
Yes, that's about 2/3 of the countries listen to our podcast. We're by far the largest mushing podcast in the world by a long shot. And I like to hang my hat on that for doing this so long. Magazine, of course, a lot of people are still reading it in Europe, Scandinavia, Germany, Finland, Denmark, Britain, you know, most of the English-speaking countries, for sure.
In all those years, a lot have changed. I can just, 87, actually, is the year I started sled dog racing.
Yeah, I started in the early 90s, and that is a lot of change. So let's switch gears and talk a little bit about you. We're going to do another episode later that really dives into your story. We've done those before, but man, things are changing for you for sure, but that's just to whet your appetite a little bit. So hit that subscribe button so you won't miss that episode. But I know you're very active here in Chugiak. We're sitting here in your living room right now, very close to the Chugiak Dog Mushers Association, a very old school type racetrack, not too far away. Tell us a little bit about that and what you do for that club and the races around here.
Well, the what I've been doing, we've been in Alaska for the last 26 years now or so. And same location in Chugiak since day one. And we've been involved at CDMA, Chugiak Dog Mushers Association, part of the board or the grooming people. Basically, I personally been maintaining the system for the last, at least 10, 15 years or so. And but everything has been changing, you know. When we came here to Alaska, the snow conditions, obviously, they were a little bit better. Last few years, we've had tough weather. But they were races with, dozens and dozens of participants in each class. I remember going to TRC, Tok Race of Champions, and there were like 60, 80 teams in six-dog class or 20, 30 teams in open class. And but now it's expensive. It's people that don't have time. They don't want to put the energy, and they are getting into dry land racing, monosports, smaller teams, and just the numbers are unfortunately dwindling in the true sled dog racing or the Alaskan ways that we know. We had to build dry land trails here locally, actually. I've worked on those trails for years and years, and we were able to put together, a couple of 2 mile, 3 mile loops so people that can use carts and scooters and bicycles, things that we didn't have 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, I guess. But definitely the nature of this sport is changing, and it wasn't uncommon to go to the track this time of the year and see, 15, 20 dog trucks parked and starting, hooking up dogs and going out training, and definitely a different feel right now than it was before. It is the nature of the beast. Everything is changing. Everything is changing. Different sports in NASCAR is changing. So I guess we are not the only sport.
Evolving.
Evolving. Definitely.
Speaking of evolving, both you and I are on the board for the Chugiak Dog Mushers Association, which I believe has been around since the 50s, 60s or so. We hold two major races, the Eagle River Classic, which we've talked about on our podcast before, and we're going to talk about that in just a second. But we also started a dry land race, 10, 12 years ago or so. And by far, as you said, that is the highest entry for our races. A whole bunch of people enter that, which is interesting.
That is true, Robert, because when we started, the idea was to have an event mimicking a little bit the lower 48 trend that we had, 10 years ago, which currently is the main trend down there. ISDRA, International Sled Dog Racing Association, used to have a circuit of sled racing events and all snow events, 4, 6, 8, 10, and open. And now, unfortunately, we don't even have enough teams to accommodate the medal status that they used to have. We don't have any winners of those medals for those years. And but the dry land here, as if you remember, I believe it was sponsored by Speedy Glass the very first year. And we had, 40, 50, 60 participants, which for us in Alaska, that's huge considering that there are probably 5 carts in the whole state of Alaska. And rigs, it's very popular down south. People, they come and go through the events. But here it's still very, very new. And we definitely have a lot of membership focusing on that currently. So that is definitely the evolution.
Welcome to the Mushing Podcast. It's time for another memorable moment in mushing history. Sponsored by Peak Experience, providing experiential and team-building courses.
From February 1984, Harris Dunlap took the lead in the first two heats of the Alpo Internationals on the three-day weekend of January 27th, 28th, and 29th by playing cat and mouse with his nearest rival, Doug McRae of Wisconsin. On the Friday run, the New Yorker established his lead of a minute and 30 seconds, which carried him all the way through the race for the win. On Saturday, he and McRae ran within the same 48-minute range for the 15.7-mile trail, but Dunlap stretched his edge by 53 more seconds. With better than 2 minutes to spare, Dunlap left the starting line in the final heat, knowing that McRae would have to pass him to be assured of a win, and that never happened. When the chips were down, McRae took the day money for the Sunday run, besting Dunlap by 7 seconds, but the race still belonged to the native son Musher with a 2-minute lead after 3 days of running. Eddie Streeper of British Columbia finished a distant third, just under the 5 minutes off the winning pace. He recouped from his disappointing Friday run, which was 3 minutes off the lead time, and ran the second and third heats in times more comparable with the two front runners. His Sunday run earned him the third place day money.
So speaking of the Eagle River Classic, I know that's sort of your baby, if you will. You not only set the trails with it, but you've also won that race many times, which we're going to talk about on your episode. But I remember on our podcast before, people used to say, you have some of the best trails in the world here in Chugiak. Why do they say that? I know you've raced in many other places compared to me.
I've raced different continents, actually, and many different places. This is obviously my home trail, and I've spent hours and hours and hours, thousands of hours, improving those trails, making them wider, safer, faster, you name it. Getting grants for the club to improve our system. It is one of the best. Why? Because it's very technical compared to the rest of the stuff we have in Alaska. It's hilly compared to the rest of the stuff we have in Alaska. We have some hills. They have their own names, actually, because they're so steep. Or for us, I guess they're steep. We have one called the Heartbreak Hill because it is right before the finish line, and it's a straight shot going up the hill, mountain, whatever you want to call it. We have different sections of lakes, hills, sharp curves, culverts going through tunnels, going through some bridges, small bridges, not huge ones, but still. Also crisscrossing a lot of G's and a lot of haws. And back when I started here, these trails, they used to be like 4 feet wide. Now it is... it's almost 8 feet wide. The groomer that we use right now, it's seven and a half feet wide. So passing, it's way easier. Back in the days when I did, it was you got behind a dog team and you had to basically thread the needle going by and try to pass because it was tight. And your dogs, you better have good leaders to be able to do this pass. And the classic, you probably don't remember, but it was not even a limited class. And through the years, it became more and more. And unfortunately, last year, we didn't have it because we didn't have snow, but we didn't have open class anymore because there are not enough teams in open class to maintain the number of the participants. So we only had a 10 dog. But when I started, it was mainly an open class race and Eagle River Classic. And we used to go, you know, all the way down our system and go through the military base, Jay Bear, which after, 9/11, we were unable to go through the military. We used to go over a giant lake in the back called Clooney Lake and come back. All those trails are gone. Unfortunately, we don't have access to those anymore, so we do two loops in order to maintain a 16-miler distance for the open teams. But we had the open class, and then we had a one-day event. I believe it was Saturday or maybe it was Sunday, only for a six-dog event. And that was where the little guys, back then I ran six-dog, and we were able to hang out with the big boys, the open class drivers, and we were just going to kind of get the crumbs as the open teams are running. And but unfortunately, those are long, long gone. And so initially what we did when Deanna and myself we joined the club, we added the limited class. So actually the limited class, they were able to race with the open class drivers. So we had a four, six, and eight, and open. And that carried throughout many, many years. And with dwindling number of the open class, unfortunately, last few years, we had to reduce the, or actually eliminate the open class and just make it a 10-dog class. So the 8-doggers and the open class guys, they can just create enough teams to maintain a class of its own. But that's a little bit of the background.
Yeah, lots of history there. And Karosh, I know you have some questions for me that we've been asking on all of our podcasts, but I have one final question for you before we turn the table, so to speak, is you've reached out to me and said, Robert, we should bring this back, this podcast back. And we had a few year hiatus. I think the last one recorded was before COVID, if I remember correctly. Why did you want to bring this back? Why are we sitting here today?
It was right before COVID, actually. I believe we went through, a lot of people, of course, that we interviewed. I find that it is for people who've been around the sport for a long time, and I consider myself being in the sport for a long time. This is my 40th year of racing. I started racing in 87 with Siberian Huskies way back then. And I think we owe it to this sport to do whatever we can to keep it alive and promote it. It is changing, but we should not let it die. We have to evolve. We have to understand where our new members are, where we can bring some fire and put in participants' bellies and get some momentum and energy back to the sport. If it's not open class, it can be scooter, for what I care. And just bring back this this fire and add some fuel to the fire and get people excited again, get people to know each other a little bit more. We always, talk about it. Back when we raced, at the end of the races, we hung out. We, talked to the other participants and, tell each other stories. What happened to you on the trail? This is what happened to my trail or whatever. Now it's the instant gratification, right? You race, you throw a couple of results and a couple of pictures on your social media feed, and goodbye, and see you next week or whatever. And it's changing, obviously, because a lot of people, they have opinions now, and you see it very clearly on social media. As you can see, we talked about it, people with no experience or very small experience, they have their very strong opinions, and there are usually the same few people on social media that you see trying to promote the sport or promote themselves, whatever it is. And I think bringing this back will bring a little bit of spotlights, put some spotlights on some of the people who are out there, and so we can know them a little bit more, so they're not just a profile picture or a reels on Instagram, and hopefully people, they will listen to it and have fun,
So speaking of that, in the upcoming weeks, we have a whole bunch of dry land racers that a lot of people probably don't know, who are doing very well in the mono sports or dryland sports. We have a couple of Canadians, a couple of champions, one really badass lady named Mickey Douglas, who we're going to talk to. I'm excited to talk to her. And then a story about bear hunting dogs and sled dogs, which is upcoming as well. So needless to say, we are back, at least for the foreseeable future. Looking forward to this. This will air on the Mushing podcast feed, but you can hit that subscribe button and get these as well. So I understand you have some questions. I've never been asked these questions.
So,
I'm usually the one to ask.
We're going to turn the table here and have fun with you for once. And we always ask, actually I've been lately asking people, we always talk very seriously about this sport, and don't forget about the fun or crazy or weird things that have happened to us on the trails. Tell me something funny or something crazy that happened to you on the trail.
Like everybody says, there has been so many interesting things that have happened. I remember one of my first years here in Alaska, I was out on a training run, and they always said, watch out for moose. And it was over on a trail that you were very familiar with near our house, the Deception Swamp Trails.
Yep.
And I remember the snow then was well above sled level, and I was just tooting along, and all of a sudden I had a 12 dog team, and all of a sudden all of my dogs' ears went back, and this huge moose literally just jumped over my dogs and just took off like he didn't even know we were there. And I tell you what, that was one of the scariest experiences I've ever had. I mean, this thing is huge. What, 1,000 pounds, maybe?
Oh, more than that, size of a horse, right?
Yeah, and he just came out from the, I don't even know if it's a male or a female, but he just came out from the left side of me, and I saw him just sort of just walk over our team and just carry on like we weren't even there. What an experience.
That did hurt any dogs?
No, he literally jumped over.
Like jumped over, yeah. Like.
As we ran by, he was just sort of cruising.
Oh my God, that's scary. It happened to me a few times, but you got lucky. You didn't get kicked by those things.
Oh yeah.
Absolutely. Something you've been asking a lot of people is music and songs. What is the artist or what is the song you listen to when you are going to races, or what you prefer to listen to?
I listen to everything. I'm more of a hard rock, heavy metal guy. We go to concerts all over the country, and I was thinking about this before we recorded, and I always think about baseball players and their walk-up songs. You always hear those songs when they come on, and I'm thinking of one right now from the band Metallica, and it's a song called Blackened. And I would have to say that's probably my favorite walk-up song.
You're a heavy metal guy, huh?
Heavy metal guy.
Very good, very good. Second one is, other than your phone, if you have to carry something with you, what would it be?
I travel a lot, and I think that I could probably say a lot here because I am definitely a gear and tech nerd. But when I am out on the trail, I'm always listening to music. And I still use wired headphones on a training run. I like those because you can pop those out of your ears, and you can still hear versus a pair of ear pods or something. And I have an old pair of old Bose headphones that sound terrific still, and that's probably my go-to.
Very good, very good. And last question. I know that you're kind of a foodie guy because on your social media, sometimes you put the food stuff that you're buying from different restaurants or drinks, fancy drinks that you make at home, and you show off your bourbons and everything to us. If you had to pick a snack, food, or something like that from a gas station, restaurant, or something, what would you pick?
You know, I was just in South Korea last week at the time we were recording this, and we pulled into a truck stop, and everybody there eats ramen. They eat ramen for breakfast. They eat ramen for lunch, dinner, snack, everything. They had a ramen library. It had like 200 cups of ramen there. And I told my wife, Michelle, when we pulled in, I said, if I had to have one meal for the rest of my life, it would probably be ramen. And I would have to say, if I was in the middle of nowhere, whether I'm in South Korea on a very busy highway or at a truck stop in the middle of Wyoming, I would probably get a cup of ramen.
Right on. Very good. Yeah. Very good. I like ramen too, actually. Yes. It's a good food.
Yes. So, guys, like I said, we are back. I'm looking forward to this. We have 7 episodes coming up here very quickly. If you have guests that you would like to have on the show, they don't have to be famous. We love hearing from the little guys. That's where we learn the most from, because they have their triumphs and their struggles. And as KP will talk about in his episode, there are times when this seems like work. It's no longer just a recreational activity. So it's always fun to talk to people that are still finding the pure passion of the sport. So definitely stick around with us. KP, anything else before we go?
No, I'm looking forward to listen to the stories and make new friends and talk to some of the old friends that we've talked to many, many years ago.
Very good, guys. We'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.
Are you a fan of the great outdoors? Do you enjoy the thrill of speed and adventure? Then listen up. Introducing Mushing, your ultimate guide to the exciting world of dog-powered sports and mushing. Whether you're a seasoned musher or just starting out, Mushing has got you covered. Get ready to immerse yourself in captivating stories of incredible sled dog races, expert training tips from seasoned professionals, and gear reviews to help you make the right choices for your team. From the breathtaking landscapes of Alaska to the snowy trails of Scandinavia, Mushing takes you on a thrilling journey through the world of dog-powered sports. Don't miss out on the latest issue, packed with exclusive interviews with top mushers, in-depth articles on sled dog nutrition, and stunning photography that will transport you to the heart of the action. So whether you're dreaming of competing in the Iditarod or simply want to learn more about this incredible sport, Mushing is your go-to resource. Subscribe now and get ready to unleash your passion for mushing. Visit our website at mushing.com or find us on your favorite podcast platform. Mushing, where the spirit of adventure meets the power of the pack.